From NPR News and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's here and now. It is a big day in the U.S. House. Democrats in the chamber are taking an unprecedented step this afternoon. They're trying to pass a resolution to block President Trump's emergency declaration on border security, and they think they have the votes. The president plans to build a wall with money that Congress has not approved for that use. The money would come from, in part, the military's budget. This morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told members of the American Legion that the president's plan, quote, steals billions of dollars from military construction funds.
As I say, if it were truly an emergency, we'd all be there with the president of the United States. Our founders had great vision. They did not want a king.
This morning, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy brushed off concerns, including from some of his fellow Republicans, that the president's declaration is an unconstitutional presidential power grab. He says Democratic presidents have used this kind of power because that's what Congress gives them. Joining us from Capitol Hill is NPR's congressional correspondent Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good afternoon.
The House is expected to vote to block the president's declaration today. Is there any chance that when the measure gets to the Republican-led Senate, the Senate could follow suit?
I think there's an increasingly good chance. The Senate is in a very Senate-specific logjam right now in that it'll need, assuming every Democrat votes in favor of this resolution, which is very likely, you'll need four Republicans to break ranks in order for the measure to pass. Right now, three Republicans have said they will vote in favor of this resolution condemning President Trump's decision trying to overturn it. That's Tom Tillis of North Carolina, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Susan Collins of Maine. That means the next Republican to say they're voting this way will be viewed as the deciding vote, and no Republican wants to be the person breaking that logjam. I suspect after vote number four materializes, several other Senate Republicans will come forward. But right now, there is a whole lot of no comments. I'm still studying it. I need to take a look.
Who's being watched, by the way, for that possibly changing sides?
I would say two camps of Republican senators. One are the handful of Republicans in states that Democrats really feel like they can challenge in 2020 and pick up a seat. Lawmakers like Cory Gardner of Colorado. The other is the increasingly growing camp of Republicans who, you know, side with President Trump on a lot of things, but have been increasingly critical of his foreign policy decision making. Two votes to look for there are Marco Rubio of Florida and newcomer Mitt Romney of Utah. Neither of them have said definitely which way they'll vote, but both have been pretty critical of this initial decision to declare a national emergency.
This morning we spoke with Republican Congresswoman Debbie Lesko from Arizona. She told us that she is voting with the president today, but at the same time she also said she's concerned about an Air Force base in her district possibly losing funding if the president uses military money to get his border wall built. Let's hear from her.
This is very early in the preliminary stages of what will be taken or transferred from other funds. But first, the very last one, what I've been told would be any military construction on bases here in the United States. And so I think Luke Air Force Base is totally protected.
It sounds like from what Debbie Lesko is saying and from what you said, Scott, that this vote is putting some Republicans in a rather difficult fix.
Yeah, I think so. And one thing I'm curious to see is how many House Republicans vote in favor of this measure. We're not really sure right now. Only one co-sponsored it. Basically, every House Democrat has co-sponsored this resolution, or almost every House Democrat. I do think you'll get a handful of House Republicans voting for it, somewhere in the range of up to a dozen or so. Very curious who they are, what states they come from, because if this does pass the Senate as well, it'll go to President Trump's desk. He said he would veto it, and that would set up override votes where you would need two-thirds in the House and the Senate. I think that hurdle is very high. It'd be very hard to get there, But Democratic leaders in the House are saying the point here is to stand our ground and say Congress does not view this as acceptable.
Scott Detrow, NPR congressional correspondent, speaking to us from Capitol Hill. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump's former lawyer and personal fixer Michael Cohen is on Capitol Hill today, speaking behind closed doors. He'll publicly testify tomorrow before his three-year prison term begins in May. He's pleaded guilty to a number of crimes, including campaign finance violations connected to hush money payments to women who say they had affairs with Donald Trump before the 2016 election. So what will Cohen's testimony tell us? Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney appointed by President Obama. She's now a professor of law at the University of Michigan. Barbara, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much, Eric.
Michael Cohen once said he would take a bullet for Donald Trump, but he's turned against him. He's cooperating with the Mueller probe and speaking out against the president. What do you see as the most important questions Congress will ask him?
Well, I think the most important questions will probably come in the two closed-door interviews on Tuesday and Thursday with the two intelligence committees. Those are the ones who are permitted to ask questions about the Russia investigation, and I think that's where the very interesting material might come out. But even in the open hearing that is before the Oversight Committee tomorrow, I think there could still be some very interesting questions relating to the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, whether President Trump did indeed direct him to make those payments, any coordination with President Trump, and also bigger picture issues about President Trump's finances, money laundering with Russians, tax questions, why the president is so guarded about his tax returns. I think there are a number of things that could be asked and revealed in that session.
And there are reports that Mr. Cohen will back up his statements, not just with personal experience and anecdotes, but with documents. That could be new, yes?
Yes, and I would think that he is correctly anticipating that his credibility is tarnished, and so the documents might speak more loudly than Mr. Cohen tomorrow.
And there are reports that, you know, he may talk about Mr. Trump's use of racist language, misstating his wealth, his income. But do you expect potentially allegations of criminal conduct could come out of these hearings?
I think it could. I think one thing where Michael Cohen is probably going to be careful is he has probably talked with Robert Mueller and his team, who, by the way, cannot prohibit Michael Cohen from answering these questions. But they might counsel him that, you know, it doesn't help our investigation for you to publicly disclose certain facts that we're investigating because it tips off other people who might be under investigation. And so that'll be a really interesting dynamic to watch. It could be, and I think it's likely, that Michael Cohen will decline to answer some of the questions that he knows that either Mueller and his team or the Southern District of New York are looking at. The Democrats probably don't want to do anything to damage those investigations, and the Republicans are probably reluctant to have them just come out and smear the president. And so it could be that we see both sides kind of defer to those efforts by Michael Cohen to decline to answer certain questions. We'll see. They could push it. They could subpoena him and demand his answers. But I think in light of what's going on with those two pending investigations, we may not see all that much that's actually new and criminal. Now, that doesn't mean that we couldn't learn some very unflattering things about President Trump or some things unrelated to those two pending investigations.
Barbara, President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, has called Cohen a convicted criminal and a liar. And Cohen did plead guilty to lying to Congress. He has a credibility issue. Why should we believe anything he says to Congress?
Yeah, I do think that that's a fair point, and I think that there's can be some skepticism. And I think that's a question he should be asked under oath. But I think, number one, bringing objective documents that can corroborate what he says will be helpful to his cause. I also think that he can say that at this point he has nothing left to hide. He has pleaded guilty. His previous lies to Congress were to protect people in the administration. He doesn't have any motive anymore other than to sort of clear his own name.
Barbara, pulling back a little bit, the Mueller probe is winding down, and there's been much debate about whether you can indict a sitting president. If Robert Mueller has damning information about the president but does not indict him, what happens to that information? Where does it go?
Well, it's not 100% clear, and I was a little concerned by the statements of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein yesterday, who again repeated the Department of Justice policy not to publicly make statements derogatory to individuals if they are not charged. Is he foreshadowing the way he sees the Robert Mueller report to be handled? It's a little bit unclear. The regulations really only require Mueller to provide a report to Attorney General Barr, and then Attorney General Barr to provide his own report to Congress, which could be a very brief report. Now, he did say during his confirmation hearings that he favors full transparency consistent with law, regulations, and policy. And so they have a fair amount of discretion to just say, I mean, one scenario he absolutely could do is to say Robert Mueller is done and there are no further charges, period. I don't think the public or Congress would stand for that kind of result. And if that were the case, I think we would see Congress picking up the mantle and trying to expose some of what Robert Mueller found in that investigation. So my hope is that we'll see something in between, even if it is not charges of the president. I do think Robert Mueller will abide by that Department of Justice policy. And if there is sufficient evidence of high crimes and misdemeanors, that will be made available to Congress for them to decide whether it's appropriate to initiate impeachment proceedings.
Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney appointed by President Obama. She's now a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. Barbara, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Eric.
The U.S. and the Taliban are expressing cautious optimism about the latest round of peace talks aimed at ending the 18-year war in Afghanistan. Key sticking points include the Taliban talking directly with the U.S.-backed government in Kabul and the militant group pledging not to let terrorist groups use its territory in exchange for the U.S. agreeing to pull its troops out of the country. CNN international correspondent Clarissa Ward and producer Selma Abdulaziz recently got rare access to the Taliban. Her report aired last night. And Clarissa Ward joins us now from New York. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me on, Eric.
Well, Western reporters almost never get direct sort of on-the-ground access to the Taliban. And you could argue our image of the group has really been shaped by stock footage and quotes from Taliban intermediaries. Why do you think they let you in? Is this kind of access a sign that the peace process is reaching a kind of a new pivotal phase?
I think it's definitely a sign that the Taliban wants to show that it can be a little bit more pragmatic and that it is now more concerned about its public image. At the same time, I don't think you're going to see the floodgates open and for a lot of journalists to suddenly be allowed access into this world. This is a world that, as you said, has been shrouded in secrecy, basically completely inaccessible to outside visitors since 9/11. The real crucial factor in our invitation was that we worked with an incredibly well-respected, award-winning Afghan filmmaker, Najibullah Qureshi, and he was the one who really facilitated the negotiations with the Taliban. And it was presented to the Taliban essentially as, I, Najibullah Qureshi, am coming in and I'm bringing a couple of women from CNN with me. So because of the way custom works out there, they didn't pry as to more information about who we were or what we were about. That would be seen as being disrespectful to Naj. So it was really on his great reputation that we were able to gain this access.
Clarissa, the visit was choreographed by the Taliban. What struck you, though, in moments that weren't choreographed?
Well, you say it was choreographed, but actually, Eric, we were the ones who told them what we wanted to see. We told them we wanted to visit a hospital, we wanted to visit a school, we wanted to interview some of the more senior leaders in that district. There was no question that obviously once we had given them that list of things we wanted to see that they were orchestrating it to a certain extent. But I did have a sense they were not interfering with our work. When we came to the clinic, they stood outside and allowed us to go inside and move around and talk to who we pleased and do as we want. We did have an instance in the interview that I did with some of those young girls in the madrasa or religious school where I was asking them who can read, who cannot, and there was a Taliban man standing by the side of us who I sort of understood that he was essentially prompting the girls to put up their hands. But for the most part, I didn't feel that the trip was as choreographed as I would have expected. I think what the Taliban wants to show right now is, listen, we can sit down at the negotiating table with the grown-ups. We can cooperate with the Afghan government in running institutions like hospitals and schools. And in the areas under our control, we can govern effectively. This is very much the message that they want to get out there.
And right away into your visit, you see a little girl who's struck by a motorcycle driven by a Taliban fighter. Let's take a listen.
A boy rushes over to help her.
It seems like the girl might have been badly hurt, but the local doctor just gives her some painkillers and sends her away. And your report pointed out that while the Taliban runs the health clinic there you visited, the Afghan government in Kabul pays the salaries and medicine. How common is that de facto cooperation across Afghanistan today?
I think it's becoming more and more common, particularly in territory that is contested. You see more cooperation like this, where the government will pay salaries, the Ministry of Health will provide medicine, but the Taliban is responsible for the day-to-day. This is also the same with schools in some areas, and there have even been instances of the Taliban and Afghan security services manning the same checkpoints, essentially working shifts, because I do think there's a growing realization on all sides that the status quo cannot continue, that people cannot continue to live in this abject horror that has come with decades and decades of war. That scene with the girl was so harrowing because all I could hear from inside the vehicle, I was right next to where she was hit, was this shrieking and this shrieking. But what was even more shocking was the sort of nonchalance of people around us. They are so inured now to daily violence. They've seen so much that a little girl getting hit by a motorcycle simply because she didn't display any outward signs of being grievously injured, it just didn't even raise an eyebrow.
And later on, you visit a madrasa or a religious school where both boys and girls are going to school together, at least when they're young. They're separated, as you point out, at puberty. Did you see anything there that shows the Taliban might be changing or relaxing their strict laws, you know, restricting girls' access to education?
I think on the surface, one was struck by, oh, look, there are girls here. That would not have been the case, 19, 20 years ago. But then when you start scratching beneath the surface and, you know, I was interviewing this teacher and he was saying, listen, girls are encouraged now to be educated. They can become doctors. They can study science or math or religious studies. But when you scratch beneath the surface, you realize that this idea that once women or girls reach puberty, they can no longer be educated in the same building as boys. Well, that's exactly the same excuse that the Taliban used in the late 90s to essentially deprive millions and millions of girls of education. It was sort of, oh, we don't have a problem with it in principle, but logistically, the emirate is not yet ready to facilitate single-sex education. And so until we get that up and running, sorry, girls, but you have to stay at home. But most importantly, Eric, was sort of illuminating to me, people there didn't really seem to care that much because women's education in these impoverished rural areas simply is not a priority.
And you and your CNN producer were made to wear the full face veil, and as women made to walk behind the Taliban at times, sort of a stark reminder of how different the Taliban treat women versus the Kabul government.
Yes, there's no sense that they're becoming any more progressive in their attitudes towards women. While we were on the street or out in public, we had to wear the niqab. And yes, there was that one instance where there was a brouhaha about whether or not we could be seen walking on the street with one of the Taliban governors, and it was decided we couldn't, and we had to sort of trail the men at a distance, which is something I have not experienced before in my career, and I've traveled in a lot of very conservative places. At the same time, when we were at the clinic, there was a woman there, a 22-year-old midwife called Fazila. She was wearing a hijab or a headscarf, but she was not wearing a full veil. She seemed very comfortable talking in front of the camera, even though we had a male cameraman. And she told us, and I have to say she appeared to be sincere, that for the most part, the Taliban is no longer trying to interfere in their daily life or interrupt their daily activities. The question is, Eric, does that change once U.S. troops withdraw, once the Taliban feels it's in a position to seize victory? Does that go out the window?
I want to play one more clip from your report. This is a Taliban commander you spoke with. Let's take a listen.
Do you feel like the Taliban is winning the war?
Inshallah, God willing, we are hopeful. We are supported by God.
It doesn't really sound like the Taliban are ready to put down their guns. What is your sense after 18 years of this latest Afghan war? Is the peace process for real?
Well, I think that there's absolutely a collective sense in Afghanistan that people are tired of war. They are bone weary. They don't have enough food to eat. It is simply not sustainable to keep fighting. And I think the Taliban does feel that too. And they do believe that it's within grasping distance victory for them now, because in their minds, victory is as soon as U.S. forces leave. The question, as you rightly point out, is, okay, okay. They'll say what they need to say at the negotiating table to try to help precipitate that U.S. withdrawal. But how sincere will any cooperation between the Taliban and the U.S.-backed Afghan government be going forward? Will the Taliban quickly turn on the Afghan government and essentially try to oust it or destroy it once there are no U.S. troops left there anymore? And I think there's a very real sense that that's a possibility. And for many, especially living in urban, educated areas, Kabul, the cities, they are extremely concerned about what the future will bring once U.S. troops withdraw.
CNN international correspondent Clarissa Ward. There's a link to her report, 36 Hours with the Taliban, at hereandnow.org. Clarissa, thanks so much for speaking with us. Great work.
Thank you so much, Eric.
To London now, where there was a bit of a Brexit bombshell from British Prime Minister Theresa May today. For the first time, the Prime Minister said she would consider delaying the UK's departure from the European Union. That's supposed to happen about a month from now, but Prime Minister May has been unable to get her Brexit deal through Parliament. She spoke in the House of Commons today.
But let me be clear. I do not want to see Article 50 extended. Our absolute focus should be on working to get a deal and leaving on the 29th of March.
The Prime Minister told lawmakers they'll get to choose between leaving the European Union on schedule, with or without a divorce deal, and asking the EU to postpone that departure date. A delay would require the approval of the 27 other European Union countries. The British people voted to leave the European Union in 2016, but May has been unable to unite the country and Parliament behind a plan to do that.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell testified before members of the Senate Banking Committee today on the state of the U.S. economy.
While we view current economic conditions as healthy and the economic outlook as favorable, over the past few months we have seen some cross-currents and conflicting signals.
Those words, including cross-currents and conflicting signals, are widely scrutinized for clues about the economic outlook and the direction of interest rates in the near future. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lisa.
So you're one of those who does the scrutinizing, Mike. What is your takeaway from the Fed chair's testimony today?
Well, Jerome Powell has gained a lot of attention in recent months for basically changing his views on the economy and how the Fed should react. So my main takeaway is that today his remarks seem to indicate that his thinking hasn't really changed much since the same message he delivered at the Fed meeting in January. And that is, like you said, that the economy is still doing fine. He noted that wages have moved up. But there are some economic data points that have softened a bit and been disappointing to economists because of what he called these crosswinds, which are things like uncertainty over Brexit, uncertainty over the trade talks, the government shutdown, and a bit of an economic slowdown in Europe and China. So it's clear he's holding firm in this belief that the economy seems like it's okay, but there are some threats to it that are worth monitoring for the time being.
Many investors listen for hints about when the next interest rate hikes will come. We heard Chairman Powell describe the Fed's approach on that as patient. How are you and how is Wall Street translating that?
Wall Street's handling it very well. They're sort of interpreting it as the status quo. You know, money markets are pricing in basically no more interest rate hikes this year. What's interesting is there's a bit of a division among some of the members of the Fed. Some of them believe that if the economic data does firm up a little bit, that they should go ahead and resume interest rate increases later this year, while a few others would actually like to see inflation go above the Fed's target of 2% for a little while before they are comfortable to hike rates further. So Jerome Powell didn't really tip his hand indicating which side he's on. It kind of seems like he's in the middle waiting to see how the data unfolds before he commits to one path or the other.
We heard criticism. Elizabeth Warren, who's running for president, had criticism for the Fed. Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio, who's considering a run, was the first to speak, and he spoke quite frequently, sharply critical of the Fed's handling of the 2008 financial crisis during the hearing. Let's hear from him.
Ignoring working families was a policy failure then. It's a policy failure now.
Briefly, what is the criticism about these days?
Well, remember, these politicians a lot of times like to use these opportunities when the TV cameras are rolling to sort of make a political point rather than ask the most useful questions of the Fed chairman. And it's true of politicians on both sides of the party. Sherrod Brown also asked Powell if he agrees with Janet Yellen's remarks, which were on the Marketplace program, where she said she wasn't sure President Trump understood the economy and the Fed's role in it. And, you know, Powell very gracefully ducked that question and declined comment. Probably a good idea on his part.
All right. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you.
Author Margaret Verbal taps into her Cherokee heritage for her book, starting with her Pulitzer Prize finalist, Maud's Line. Her follow-up is out this month. The novel's set in what is now the state of Oklahoma. The land back then was called Indian Territory. The Cherokee and other tribes were removed from their land, mostly in southeastern states, and relocated there in forced marches that became known as the Trail of Tears. Thousands died along the way. Cherokee America Singer, the novel's lead character, is the matriarch of a prosperous farm family in Indian Territory, but she has her hands full taking care of a dying husband and five sons, and that's before one of her hired hands goes missing and a murder is committed that could threaten Cherokee sovereignty. The new novel, a sprawling epic, is called Cherokee America, and Margaret Verbal joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Eric. Nice to be here.
Cherokee America Singer is a fictional character, but we find out in your afterwards she was inspired by a real-life woman that your grandmother first told you about, Cherokee America Rogers. Tell us about her. What did you take from that real-life woman to create or inspire your lead character?
Well, I first heard about Cherokee America Rogers, as you said, from my grandmother. And my grandmother felt very warmly toward this woman, even though she'd been dead for many a year by the time I ever heard about her. And the reason Grandma felt so fondly of her is because when her father, who is my great-grandfather, and his brother came as orphans of the Civil War into Indian Territory trying to find work and place to live, Mrs. Rogers took them in. And she essentially made their lives. They became farmers there in eastern Oklahoma, and they married into Cherokee Indians, and they had a good life. And my grandmother was deeply grateful to Mrs. Rogers. And so that's sort of what propelled me into looking more about her life and investigating it and investigating the history of that time and place in Indian Territory.
As the daughter of a white man and a Cherokee woman, Czech, as Cherokee America Singer is known in the novel, is able to sort of live in both worlds. As you say in the book, Czech repeats family history by marrying the enemy. Her husband is a white man. How much of that idea of trying to balance both worlds is in your own family's history?
Well, I think in general, the Cherokees adopted a strategy early on of marrying into white people on the theory that whites would be less likely to kill their own children in the future. And you see that pattern again and again through Cherokee history of alliances with white people through marriage. And the whites, interestingly enough, often become enmeshed in the tribe rather than taking the Indian out and having that Indian person live as white person. So we have, I mean, John Ross, for instance, who was famous as a chief
of one faction of Cherokees,
chief at the time of the removal. Mm-hmm. He was only eighth Cherokee. He came from a Scottish family, mm-hmm. but he was culturally Cherokee.
Czech lived with her husband in Ohio before moving to Indian Territory. And at one point, you say in the book, you know, she had more rights living as a Cherokee woman than she did as a white woman in Ohio. Was that true in general of Cherokee women then, do you think?
I do think that. You know, historically, the Cherokee Nation was matriarchal and matrilineal. Mm-hmm. And the women owned everything, the house, the fields, the children. And the men sort of came and went. And the reason for that was because that they were off hunting. But it gave Cherokee women a sense of empowerment that I think that white women did not have at the time.
Let's talk a little more about the time that this novel is set in. It's just a couple of decades after the Trail of Tears, the forced movement by the U.S. government of tens of thousands of Native peoples off their lands to present-day Oklahoma. But it's set before Oklahoma became a state, thereby ending what was known as Indian Territory. Your novel shows that the position of Indians, you know, in this Indian Territory is a precarious one.
Yes, it is. The Cherokee Nation had a terrible time because with illegal immigration, and of course those were white people coming into the Cherokee Nation, and it was a constant struggle, and they'd had that struggle back east, and had been promised that if they would go out there to the west, they wouldn't have that struggle anymore. Mm-hmm. And of course immediately they started having to combat white illegal immigration into mm-hmm. their nation.
There's a murder committed in the novel, and without spoiling anything, you know, it is important who it's committed by. Can you explain that for us?
The Cherokee Nation and Indian Territory in general, and that's not just the Cherokees, but the Choctaws and, you know, the Seminoles and everybody else, they all had a problem with white crime coming in. I mean, everybody was on the run from Arkansas and Kansas and Missouri. All they had to do was go across the boundary into one of these Indian nations, and then the law couldn't pursue them. Mm. You know, a lot of these people were pretty desperate people and pretty ruthless people. And basically what the Cherokees were trying to do was that they were trying to keep their law and their courts viable. And that was a crucial part of being able to keep their sovereignty.
Margaret, racial factors come up in the novel. Czech's cook and her hired hand are freed African Americans living in Indian Territory. How common was it that blacks settled in this territory after the Trail of Tears?
Well, the Cherokees had been slave-holding Indians, and so had, I think, all of the southern tribes that were removed down there. So what you had was a class of people who were called freedmen. Mm-hmm. And then you had, for two of my African-American characters, they had always been freed people. Mm-hmm. And so there were African-Americans in Indian Territory, there were Indians, and there were white people, and there was everybody mixed up with each other. And I sort of like that. I like everybody mixed up with each other and getting along and making alliances and understanding each other.
Margaret, there were Cherokees who fought for the Confederacy in the Civil War and some who fought for the North. And during the Trail of Tears, the Cherokee Nation was divided on really how best to fight back against the U.S. government. Talk about that divide and how it comes up, even in subtle ways, in your book.
Well, I am actually descended from families that were Treaty Party families.
Your family was on the side of signing the treaty and going along with the forced removal?
Yes. We have not been portrayed very well in history. And, of course, you know, it is portrayed, and I believe it to be true, one of the great tragedies of American history. But it is also true that the Cherokee Nation is a strong and vibrant Indian nation, and there are a lot of Indian nations that are dead. And I think in the long run, we've done okay.
Margaret, as you write in your afterword, the Cherokee were deprived of their rights when Oklahoma became a state in 1907, and it took decades to reestablish the tribe. You say that they're now one of the largest employers in the state of Oklahoma. They are a strong tribe, and much has changed, of course. Is your fiction your way of attempting to recapture some of what's been lost?
Well, when I first started writing this book or thinking about it in Ring Cherokee history, I had no idea that the Cherokee Nation would be as strong and vibrant as it is today. When I was growing up, I thought this was a lost way of life, that after my grandparents' generation, that really there would be no more Cherokee Indians. And I found this heartbreaking, to tell you the truth. So I began being interested in this history long before I thought that the Cherokee Nation would have the resources it does today.
Margaret Verbal's new novel is Cherokee America. Margaret, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In 2016, the U.S. military ended its ban on transgender troops and allowed them to serve openly. President Trump moved to reinstate the ban a year later. The Pentagon says for now it's not changing anything. Tomorrow, the House Armed Services Committee will hold a hearing on policy regarding transgender military service. Michael DeJuana from member station KUNC in Greeley, Colorado, spoke with one of the transgender troops on active duty who will testify.
I'm visiting a small home near Fort Carson in Colorado Springs.
Hi.
Hi, Olivia.
You must be Michael?
I am Michael.
Come on in.
Hi, good to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
I'm
How
here
are you?
To meet Captain Olivia Stelik.
Would you like some coffee?
I would love
As
some.
We sit down
Thank
to
you.
Talk,
Black milk, sugar,
I ask what Army life is like.
I love the Army. I grew up knowing I wanted to do this, and that has not changed.
Stelik's career began 10 years ago with the infantry, and as a man. Now she's a physical therapist, and this is her first time talking about being transgender.
I would love to stay. I think that I have a lot to offer to soldiers, and that's really where my heart is.
But policy advanced by the Trump administration would bar most who are transgender from serving, including those who require or have undergone gender transition. There could be exemptions or waivers for troops with a medical history, and others could continue to serve, but they'd have to do so in their birth gender. In Stelik's case, she hopes she's grandfathered in because she came out and transitioned when it was okay to do so.
There is some uncertainty here.
A Defense Department survey estimates that about 1% of active duty military troops, or nearly 9,000, identify as transgender.
I'm announcing today that we're ending the ban on transgender Americans in the United States military.
That's President Obama's Defense Secretary Ash Carter back in 2016.
Effective immediately, transgender Americans may serve openly. And they can no longer be discharged or otherwise separated from the military just for being transgender.
GLBT advocates applauded the move that came 5 years after the military ended its Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that prevented gay and lesbian troops from serving openly.
It was pretty wild. It was unexpected, and here we are.
Before that moment, she'd resolved to keep her hopes of transitioning private.
Being in the Army was more important. And so rather than get out, it was, I'm going to stick around and, you know, maybe when I retire, I'll transition. But until then, I'm going to take care of soldiers. That's the thing that I do.
In 2017, Stelik transitioned.
I left work on a Friday and then I showed up on Monday with a different name and different pronouns and some makeup, right? That's, I mean, because I didn't have long hair at the time. And folks were remarkably gracious and lovely and kind, and it was wonderful.
So I'm thinking timeline again. Mm-hmm. Right as you made your transition, mm-hmm. Donald Trump tweets.
Yes, that happened.
That tweet said, the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. And in a reversal of prior research that showed transgender troops pose minimal impact on military readiness and healthcare costs, the president called transgender troops a tremendous medical cost burden and disruption.
So it's a group of people that statistically have shown that they're more, for whatever reason, more predisposed to suicide and severe anxiety.
former Army Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr is director of the conservative-leaning Heritage Foundation's Center for National Defense in Washington, D.C. Along with conservative Christian groups, the foundation cheered the president's actions.
The criteria that I think the Pentagon's endeavoring to apply here is fairly consistent with other situations like this, like severe depressive disorder, bipolar, other medical conditions, which, you know, indicate that military service may put them in greater harm, you know, may subject them to even more anxiety and more risk of having some sort of mental episode.
Back in Colorado Springs, Captain Olivia Stelic is shocked by the suggestion that transgender troops downgrade the overall readiness of the military. She concedes that some accommodations may need to be made, like time for those who transition, but any soldier can have a medical issue, and all must meet fitness criteria to serve.
The same process happens for every soldier before we deploy, right? It's this, do you meet the standards? Can you meet the standards? Can you deploy? And in every unit, some people don't.
And in Stelic's case, the opposite happened. When she saw that a unit was going to deploy to Afghanistan without a physical therapist, she stepped up and asked to be sent.
We're at our best when we can be whole people.
What Stelic feared most about transitioning was the possibility of being rejected. But she says she received an outpouring of support from her peers and commanders. And that's exactly what Defense Secretary Ash Carter envisioned in 2016 when he said transgender troops are part of the finest fighting force the world has ever known.
It's like family. That's I can't overstate how much this has opened communication with soldiers and with leaders and with people everywhere, folks that I don't think would have talked to me before.
The future of the ban is mired in legal challenges. For now, transgender troops just keep doing their jobs. For Here and Now, I'm Michael DeJoanna.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Eric Westerbelt. You're listening to Here and Now.